Hey, Riverfront family.
We're coming at you this week with a special bonus episode. It is episode one of a new Riverfront interview show, Red Leg Roundtable, brought to you by our very own Ohio native, Seth Shaner. Seth recently had the pleasure of sitting down with former Cincinnati Reds catcher Eddie Taubenzie, and during their hour-long conversation, they covered Eddie's path to the big leagues, his time with the Reds, and went into detail on that 1999 Red Leg squad that won the hearts of every Reds fan fortunate enough to watch and listen to them play. We're grateful to Eddie for his willingness to have this chat and grateful to Seth for making it happen. Seth plans to bring us more similar content with regularity going forward, and we could not possibly be more excited to have him on board over at the Riverfront. So without further ado, please enjoy Seth Shaner as he welcomes Eddie Taubenzie to the Red Leg Roundtable.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of the Red Leg Roundtable podcast. I'm your host, Seth Shaner. The Red Leg Roundtable podcast is an interview show centered around the Cincinnati Reds and their great history. The goal of the show is to talk to folks who have played for or worked for the Cincinnati Reds, or even those with unique stories to share about the team, the city of Cincinnati, and the stadiums they have played in. And with this being 2024, 25 years since the 1999 Reds thrilled their fans with a surprising 96-win season, I want to feature stories from that magical year. To kick off the endeavor, I am excited to welcome former Reds catcher and current college coach Eddie Taubenzie to the Red Leg Roundtable. Eddie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Seth, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Obviously, as I mentioned to you earlier, the 1999 season is a big focus of this podcast, especially for this year, 2024. Can you believe it's been 25 years since that season?
No. Oh, my gosh. That is crazy. It's just the years go by so fast. And to be honest, Seth, things like that, when I think about seasons like that and, you know, accomplishments and 25 years goes by and people still talk about it, it really reminds me of how special that was and to be a part of a team, even though we didn't make the playoffs, but it's such an amazing year, amazing run. It feels really good.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And as I mentioned to you off the air, my favorite season as a whole, and that's why sometimes, you get caught in this world where we have Twitter and we have social media and everybody wants, everything right away and all that. And sometimes it's good to remind yourself that the journey is part of the fun. And certainly that year, I mean, I could tell you stories and maybe we'll get into some of them of me, even I had to go back to my college roommate's hometown of Dayton, Ohio, from Ohio State to get a couch, as we were moving into the campus and we've got the game on and Marty Brenneman's describing Scott Williamson kind of being a little bit wild, but still getting guys out.
Just a little bit. But a little bit wild, but really good.
Yeah, certainly. Well, rookie of the year, he deserved it completely that year. So I guess let's talk a little bit about you. You were born on Halloween in 1968. Baseball Reference says you were born in Beeville, Texas, but that you graduated high school at Lake Howe High School in Winter Park, Florida. Take me through kind of your formative years and where you grew up.
Yeah, well, basically I was just born in Texas at Beeville. Back then, back in the late 60s, Beeville, Texas was a naval training camp for the Navy. My dad was stationed in the Navy and I was born there. Lived in Ohio for a little bit in Springfield, Ohio. That's okay. Where my mom's from. And when I was about a year and a half old, moved to Florida. My dad, decided to move the whole family. Not whole family. It's a really small family. Just me and my parents and the Florida where it's nice and warm. And I'd been there since I was about a year and a half old, a year old. And so I'm a Floridian, been there well over 50 years. And until the last 6 months, moved to South Carolina, the Greenville area of South Carolina, where the total change of scenery, pace, and really enjoying it.
Yeah, no doubt. So certainly the advantage is built into year-round nicer weather and things like that. You grow up in Winter Park. It was kind of serendipitous that you were drafted by the Reds in 86, and certainly you didn't end up at the big league level with them until later. But talk about being drafted in the sixth round back in 1986.
Yeah, you know, baseball back then was so different than it is now, for a couple of reasons. There's no such thing as travel ball. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as that. So, you know, your high school, you know, and all-stars after like Little League and things like that were really good baseball, really good competition. And you're just hoping your high school coach was a good coach, could teach you. And there wasn't many just academies around. You know, you had to hopefully find somebody to teach you the swing, teach you little things. And to be honest, a lot of times you're playing with your friends outside, you figuring things out, you're just playing and having fun. But yeah, I got drafted out of high school when I was a 16-year-old senior.
Wow.
I was a young high schooler and just turned 17 during my senior year. And drafted by the Reds. You know, back then the scouts had to come find you. So during playing fall ball, playing in the spring, there have been games where we had, you know, multiple over 20 scouts, almost every team represented. And in fact, you know, not only come to see me, but we were playing against a team who had a kid who was drafted the next year, second in the nation, right behind Ken Griffey Jr. His name was Mark Burchett. He was supposed to be the next kind of Mickey Mantle. He was second pick in the draft. So when we played that team, boy, there were scouts just all over the place, not only for him, but to see guys like myself.
Okay. Well, so you end up making the rounds around the minor leagues, but on May 18th, 1991, you make your major league debut for the Cleveland Indians. Describe that a little bit and kind of the circumstances behind getting called up and things like that.
Yeah, that was very interesting because I got drafted by the Reds, spent 5 years in the minors with them and had my ups and downs as a young guy, but it had years where I did really, really well. And I was on the 40-man roster one time. And then one year I had a bounce back year in the minors, thought thinking I was going to be put back on the 40-man to get back on kind of the main prospect list with the Reds. And what happened, they put me on a AAA roster that year. And so what happened, I got picked up at what's called a Rule 5 draft in the offseason. So which a team that picked me off AAA roster, they had to keep me in the big leagues a whole year or send me back. And people don't realize, I really don't talk about it, I was picked up by the Oakland A's in the Rule 5 draft. So in 1991, I went to spring training with the Oakland A's. You know, if they were going to keep me, I had to be like their third catcher in the big leagues or somehow they could get me to the minor leagues. And so this is right after the Reds had beaten them in the World Series in 1990. So I went from A ball in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I was an all-star, hit 16 homers, I think driving in like 60-something RBIs and having a good year for a young player. Then I find myself in the spring training with Mark McGwire, Ricky Henderson, Jose Canseco, Terry Steinbach, you know, all that great team of the A's, thinking, oh my gosh, am I going to be on this team? And I had a great spring training with them, really did well. And Tony Russo, and I remember going the last game of the season in spring training was the Bay Bridge Series. We flew to Oakland to play the Giants. And I remember flying into Oakland, walking into the clubhouse of the A's. I never got to see the field. Tony La Russa called me into his office, and he says, "Eddie, you know, it's the last day of spring training where hopefully the rosters were all set for all the teams. So we tried to sneak you through waivers so we could put you down on our AAA team, but the Cleveland Indians picked you up off of waivers." And I went from right to there to Cleveland. I went to the big leagues. I opened up in the big leagues in Kansas City for 4 days. And I went from A-ball to the big leagues with Cleveland. I'm sitting there opening day. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is the most awesome thing in the world. Please don't put me in the game. You know. But then from there, they were able to put me through waivers after a few days in the big league season. I was AAA with the big leagues. I skipped AA, went to AAA with the Indians. Had a really good year. Hit 310 in the minors with them. And it's just up and down a little bit during the season because Sandy Alomar would get hurt, and I got – in May, got called up, then went back down to finish the year and got called back up in September. So that's how I got to the Indians. I was picked up off of waivers from the Oakland A's. And I don't talk about playing for the A's a lot because it was such a quick thing in spring training, and yeah. I never got a chance to be in the minors with them or to the big leagues.
Well, that's an amazing story I didn't know. And And my friends would tell me that I know most everything about anybody who played for the Reds. So that's pretty interesting. A little bit of trivia, though. You were involved in a trade with the Astros and the Indians in return got Kenny Lofton. So that worked out for the Indians, and you end up going to Houston.
Actually, it worked out amazing for both of us because as I was – Houston Astros at the time, they had a great center field. They had an amazing career, Steve Finley.
Uh-huh.
You know, Steve Finley, a great – he had over 300 homers in his career, gold glover, everything. But they had a great catcher who was – you know what? They wanted to get him behind the plate and put him at second base, which was Craig Biggio.
That's right. That's right.
And so playing when I was with the Indians in AAA, we played against the Houston – the Tucson Toros was the Houston Astros. So I had some good games against them. And so myself and a guy named Dave Rohde – not Willie Blair and I were with the Indians, and we both got traded for Kenny Lofton and Dave Rohde.
Okay.
So it was like a 2-for-2. It was 2-for-2. It wasn't a 1-for-1 Eddie Thomas for Kenny, but that was kind of the main thing because they were moving Biggio to second base, and so they wanted me to come in a young player and so to do well. And so that was exciting for me. It got Kenny Lofton. People ask me what it feels like to be traded. I said, I think it's awesome because I came – a couple things. It got me to the big leagues a year or two early. You know, I'm in the big leagues at 22 years old. And, you know, and later on in 2001, I went back to the Indians. I got the chance to play with Kenny.
Yeah.
And so we got to become teammates. And to me, I love it. It was the best thing for me. I mean, I was stuck behind Sandy Alomar Jr. I got a chance to platoon with Scott Service with the Astros, and you know, I was getting better each and every year. I struggled the first year, got better the next year. I'm still a young guy, but for some reason, the Astros, you know, obviously Kenny Lofton just took off. And you know, I'm still developing slow. And then the Reds, Joe Oliver with the Reds in '94, he came down with some kind of freak injury, and not an injury, but more of a condition, like a disease. Something happened where he was out, and I got back to the Reds in '94. They traded for me, and I was able to get back. And those 7 years with the Reds, that's where I blossomed as a hitter and as a player. I got a chance to do the things I felt like I was capable of doing.
Yeah, '94, you get traded to the Reds in the middle of in the season, and you hit .294. You're on base with .345. In the modern parlance, the OPS plus, if you're over 100, you're good. You were at 118. So certainly a good first stop with the Reds. And I've got a little bit more trivia before we move it along, because I really want to dive into 1999 more than anything at this point. But
yes,
you had the last postseason hit for the Reds in the 1995 playoffs. They didn't have another postseason hit until 2010. So
yeah, I remember that somebody told me because they got no hit.
Right,
the first game
they did
of
get
the
no
playoffs.
Hit. Roy Halladay,
and when they finally got the hit, they said the last player knew it was me, and I came. I remember coming in, and I always have fun with the kids in college. The college team, I said, you know, Coach Thomas, '95, I hit .500 in the playoffs. They go, really? I said, yeah, I was 1-for-2. And they start laughing. And I'm like, well, how many hits you guys got? So maybe they should have played me more. We would have done better. But no, the Braves were the team that year for sure.
Boy, that was something else. I was at one of the home games, and it felt like Barry Larkin lived on third base in that series, and nobody could knock him in. But
yeah, that's what it was. And there were some, you know, when it happens in close games, and we had our chance. But that's what the pitching always kind of seems to come through.
Okay. So you played over 100 games in 96 and 97 for the Reds. And 98, 99, you're basically the starting catcher, the primary catcher, I guess would be the best way to put it. In 99, you had your best season. We're going to talk about that overall. But you batted .311, a .354 on base, .521 slugging. Great numbers. 21 home runs, 87 RBI, 22 doubles. Again, OPS plus a .116. Certainly that, I guess that was your peak year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. And the year before was a big year too. And I credit that to Jack McKeon. That's when he came over.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came over, he believed in me. He let me play every single day. And so I started playing every day in 98, and it was such a great thing. It was such an amazing thing and kind of scary thing, because the first month and a half of the season in 1998 for me, almost first few months, I was leading the National League in hitting.
Yes.
I was so on fire. I got a clipping where it says Eddie Thomasy, like Tony Gwynn, and John Olerud. I'm like, what's going on here? And I was so high. And they were talking about me being an all-star and things like that. I was like, whoa. I said, I've never been an all-star since minor leagues. But anyhow, I did have a good year. But that year, I did something to my wrist, and I was playing hurt the whole year, where I lost a little power. And if I missed the ball, it really hurt the swing, but it didn't hurt me to throw. And it hurt me with the power numbers, but I was able to drive in runs and do that. But in that off season was really huge. It never healed. And it's funny, about a month before spring training, it was still bothering me. I was panicking, and we ended up having to go in. A doctor had to go in and clean it out. I had to do some cleaning out with some stuff in my wrist and fix some things. And it wasn't about 2 weeks before spring training, I started hitting off a tee a little bit a week before and throwing. And then that's the first time I picked up a ball, and it started feeling better. I went into spring training in 99, coming off a surgery on my wrist. And all I did was hit off the tee for a week and play catch one time. And I was ready to go. And I came in having my best year. So that was a big deal, because I was playing hurt that year because I didn't want to disappoint Jack, and I wanted to play, keep on playing. And,
sure.
And plus, I had a year in me. I had to get used to playing every day, because before I was platooning and doing well. And then, man, just the grind of catching 120, 130 games, 125 games is a lot. It's a toll on the body. Mm-hmm. And so doing that the next year, coming back and being stronger and just being able to do more durable, I was able to put up the numbers I thought I was capable of those years before. If you see me platooning, hitting 290, 12 homers, driving in 44 runs or so, I mean, I just basically doubled the numbers that I did playing part-time.
Yeah, so definitely. You prove you're consistent, right? That was it.
I told people I was a very productive – for those 2 years, I got a chance to play every day. I was averaging about 80 runs driving in a year. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome for a catcher. And then 2000 came along. I started off the year really good, but then I blew my back out. I was kind of never the same since.
Okay. We're going to really dive into 1999, 25 years since that great season. Well, first of all, I want to tell one story. In 2012, I'm in Florida with my wife and son. We're visiting my in-laws who wintered down there. And my father and I go to an Astros spring training game against the Mets in Kissimmee. And I'm wearing a wire-to-wire Reds t-shirt. And this man walks up to me and points at my shirt and says, "I played for them." And I look down at my shirt, and I look up, and immediately I said, "You're Eddie Thomasy." So I just wanted to share that story. I'm sure you don't remember it, but my recall was pretty quick, because I was like, wait a minute, this is a 1990 red shirt, but no, that's Eddie Thomasy.
I don't remember, but if I was there in 2012, I was working for a ministry to professional ball players then, and I was visiting all the teams.
Okay.
I just happened to be visiting the Astros that day.
All right. Well, then fast forward to now. Tell me a little bit about now. I know your son Matt is a pitcher for North Greenville University, and you've signed on, and you mentioned already you've moved up there. You're residence now. You're a volunteer assistant for North Greenville University. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, North Greenville University is a Division II baseball program. Over the past 5 years, they've been ranked number one over the years. And 2 years ago, they won the national championship, the D2 national championship. And last year, I was helped volunteering coach. We lost in the World Series. Came like third or fourth in the nation. And this year, we're trying to get back there again. And so I have a son who's a big left-handed pitcher. He's really good. He led our team in earned run average last year. So he's coming back for his last year to finish strong. And hopefully, aspirations of, you never know, go on to the next level somehow.
Oh, yeah. And the picture on North Greenville's website announcing you signing on to volunteer as a coach, you're wearing a T-shirt with it's got the old school White Sox logo with NGU underneath it. That's a really neat logo on that shirt.
Really? Okay. I gotta go check it out. So we'll see what picture they get. But yeah, I really enjoy volunteering, and I love it up here because the head coach is a guy named Landon Powell, who's a big league catcher with the Oakland A's, caught a perfect game with the A's. And I just come up here and just volunteer the days that I want to, do the things I want to do, and just bring whatever I can to the team. And he loves having me around, and I love being around the coaches and the kids.
Okay, that's so cool. And I'm going to keep track this spring and see how things go. That sounds like an exciting year coming up. We'll dive into 1999. I want to just go kind of point by point. And then at the end, I want to get your take on some of your teammates and the seasons you guys had. But you went 96 and 67 that year. The one extra game is the one game playoff to the Mets. We'll get to that as we go through the season. When you went to spring training that year, we'll get into some of the changes, but certainly you can't put on a board to say, we're going to win 96 games. But what was the vibe? Do you remember what it was like in spring training that year, how it might have been a little different around the room?
Well, you know, we knew it was different run reason. We were excited about the year because we had facial hair. and because we had signed Greg Vaughn.
That's right.
from the San Diego Padres. So that, to be honest, that was the most exciting thing about spring training is everybody, if you probably look at that year, everybody had a goatee. Most everybody was trying to grow some facial hair because Greg Vaughn was coming over and he wasn't going to come over unless he could have his goatee. So, hey, having Greg Vaughn around, we knew we were going to be competitive, and with the division we were in the Central, that, you know, things come together, you know, hitting wise and talent wise. We knew with Casey and Larkin and Vaughn, you know, we had some hitters. But what the big thing was good about it is the players like myself, Pokey Reese, Aaron Boone, we had Dimitri Young and others. Just, we all kind of played to our potential. We stay healthy. We stayed together. And in our pitching, if you look at our pitching staff, there's not like one huge big name, but we had guys who, especially if it's starters, good enough starters that they stay healthy. They're quality major league pitchers. But then it is really our bullpen was really strong that year. That
Absolutely.
really solidified our pitching staff.
Now Vaughn and Mike Cameron were new to the team that year. They both came over in trades. Vaughn had hit 50 home runs and gone to the World Series with the Padres the year before. But they come over in trades, Cameron for Paul Konerko, when there was a glut at first base. And I guess I remember sitting up the night before the season, or maybe it was right before you would have departed Florida to go north. And Baseball Tonight had Greg Vaughn and Mike Cameron on set, and they interviewed the two of them. And I thought, my goodness, I must have been home with my parents or something. I was a college student, and I just remember thinking, wow, this guy seems different. And I don't know, you know, winners can say team chemistry matters, and then people say, yeah, but what about the losing teams that all got along well? What happened there? But Greg Vaughn, he came in and seemed to set a tone. Was that true? Was that kind of the media narrative? Was that true?
He certainly did set a tone. But Barry Larkin was our captain. He was everything to us. Barry Larkin. He set the table, how to play, how to be a Red. But Greg Vaughn brought the intensity. He brought the intensity, and you know what? He hated to lose. And it's one of those things that, man, after getting you lost, man, you just didn't want to hear. He let everybody know. And it was not a good feeling because, you know, he's just been to the World Series. He wants to get back there again. And so really we learned a lot as young players, myself and others, you know, all good, really good talent, but we learned how to grind, how to fight, and just kind of really go in every day thinking there's no team. We don't care who's pitching, who's out there, that we have a shot. We should beat them.
Sure. And well, to your point there, the pitching staff, which you had to handle as the primary catcher, Pete Harnisch, Denny Nagel. Nagel had some injury time that year. Brett Tomko was a young starter. Ron Valone, you talk about grinders. He went toe-to-toe with Randy Johnson, won a 1-0 game. He had games where he only gave up one hit over 7 or 8 innings. Steve Parris was an unsung hero that year. And, of course, you mentioned the bullpen. Danny Graves was the primary closer, but Scott Williamson was Rookie of the Year, and, my goodness, nobody could touch him. Talk a little bit about the staff as a whole and maybe some individual guys.
Yeah, the staff was good. I mean, you know, Pete Harnisch was kind of our workhorse in a lot of ways, because if he stayed healthy, you kind of knew every what you're going to get out of him every inning, every outing. You know, if he's hitting his spots, things like that, he's going to give you a chance. He's going to give you 5+ innings, and he won 16 games for us that year. And you know, Tomko was young, and he came in there. You know, he's still learning how to pitch, but he came in there, and he had some electric stuff as a starter. But obviously, we had a lot of veterans. And obviously, Valone, he kind of did it there. He starts and he relieve a little bit later on too. But he was strong. He gave us some big innings and big games, and he came. He showed up when we needed him. And he was really durable that year. But as Steve Parris, as you said, he was a unsung hero. You know, it's something you were going to say he was going to go 11-4 that year with like a 3.5 Ernie around there. Mm-hmm. You would have said, really?
Yeah.
You know, cause you kind of think of him more of as a just kind of like a stock pitcher. So, but basically that year he put it together for us that year. And obviously with our hitting, we scored some runs, made him feel comfortable. And so we had, you know, we always had a lot of guys too, you know, with Avery, we had Juan Guzman, veteran type of guys who kind of like, you know, can they come back? They're coming off of injuries and, you know, trying to get their stuff back again. Cause in fact, you know, Juan Guzman did really well for us that year, but I think he got hurt. And
yeah,
later on, or did we trade him? I don't remember.
Well, Guzman, he made 12 starts. He basically came after at the trade deadline. He made 12 starts at a 3.03 ERA, but I do think he ran out of gas late.
I don't remember how in the playoffs we're going to use him. But if you think about it, we had no starting pitcher go over 200 innings.
Nope. 198 for Harnisch. Yep.
We had three relievers. Oh, you know, we had a couple in the hundreds, and I think probably Scott Williamson was pretty close to 100 innings pitched. So you could see what Jack did there. Boy, he liked to bring in those bullpen. We had three guys, you know, around 100 innings in the bullpen. Our bullpen really carried us a lot that year. We had a really good bullpen. Those guys in the bullpen, their earned run average was probably a good run less than our starters.
They were. And Danny Graves had 111 innings. And then Scott Sullivan, 113. I think he actually had like 3 years in a row with over 100 innings, which is, you know, people today wouldn't believe, because you just don't see relievers throwing that kind of innings. And then Williamson had 93 innings. And you're right. They were all Williamson had a 2.41 ERA, Sullivan 3.01, Graves was 3.08. Yeah, really amazing. And young Dennis Reyes, 3.79. Yeah. Yeah.
Gabe White he was a lefty. He was nasty. He just carved up other lefties. He had really good stuff. His ball never went straight.
Well, and people will bemoan maybe Jim Bowden in kind of his era as Reds general manager, but he made that trade. He got Dennis Reyes and Paul Konerko. He spun Konerko for Mike Cameron, and Dennis Reyes was a bit of a good find there for 2 or 3 years. He's pretty young too at the time. He was only 22 in that year in 1999. So certainly a big help for your team. You started not super fast, but then you go 18-9 in June. We're going to go through the season a little bit, but the crazy thing to me is, even though you did not go to the playoffs, you went 19-9 in September. So you didn't wilt down the stretch. That was a very fun month of September trying to get in the playoffs. Hal McCoy from the Dayton Daily News called you the big road machine. You went 51-30 on the road.
Yeah, we certainly did. Yeah, it's funny. You talk about, you know, the month of April, we're just kind of finding out kind of who we were. I mean, I don't think we even had a good April. I think we're below 500 in April, and we're just, you know, we're just kind of, okay, we're trying to find ourselves and figure things out. And really starting in May and June, we really started to get it together. And I tell you what, I think in June we really started to do it. And I think we had a couple streaks where we won about 8 or 9, 10 games in a row, but it was right. I tell you, when we really believed we could win this thing, this whole thing, is because we started playing good. It was right before the All-Star break in late June. We were playing, we had a 10 game series where we played Arizona and Houston for 10 straight games.
Right.
And we won them all. And these were all first place teams. And we won them all. And we went into the All-Star break and we thought, oh my gosh, we just ran through Arizona and Houston and I said, we will come back, like, let's do this the second half of the year. Let's do it. That's really, I think, where we started kicking in. And really, we had a better second half, I believe, than the first half.
Oh, yeah, you certainly did. And to your point, you were 9-12 in April, but then you went 16-10, 18-9, 16-12, yep. 17-12, and then I mentioned 19-9.
September, we rocked in September, but the bad part is so did Houston.
They did. They were right there. You were a game ahead or a game behind the whole month, it felt like. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so did the Mets.
Mm-hmm, unfortunately.
all those teams had a great September, sure. Which was horrible. I mean, what's kept us in it, but also it just made for an amazing fight down the end.
Well, hey, I've taken down a few key games. You mentioned that late stretch, and I have Baseball Reference up now. That you're absolutely right. Arizona and Houston, and I remember they made a big deal out of the West Coast road trip. I think you had a 9-1 trip there at one point, and that was always That's the local media would say, well, they're doing okay, but they've got a 9-gamer out west coming up, because they were kind of scarred by all the years the Reds played in the NL West, you know, and they had to go out west, and it was a time change and all that, and playing so many games out there, but. Let me go through a few highlights I've put down, and if you remember any different, you can bring those up as well. But Friday, April 16th, we mentioned you didn't have the best April, but you had a walk-off win against Pittsburgh, and it may have been the first time, and remember this, they called it the Stomp, where nobody had really done this before. Take me through the genesis of celebrating at home plate for when somebody had a walk-off win.
Okay. I talk about this with my wife all the time, and it's funny. I think Aaron Boone could confirm this, because Aaron Boone was there. I forget who hit the homer. Was it Sean Casey, or was somebody? Was it a game-winning homer? Game-winning hit?
Let me pull this up here. I don't know if that's the game, but that's your first walk-off win of the year.
Yeah, it's a walk-off. But I remember going to home plate, and the person scoring the it was a walk-off homer for sure.
Uh-huh.
And so as they were rounding, I remember being at home plate, and it was like we're just all like gathered around it. And I remember, you know, I remember saying, "Let's jump up and down," you know, jumping up and down. We all just started jumping up and down, and that's to me, that's how it started. I think I started it because I remember saying that, doing that, and we just started jumping up and down. And I think it was Aaron Boone maybe hit the homer. Aaron Boone was a part of it somehow.
Okay. Yeah, that was a Hal Morris double. So it must not have been in the April one. But yeah,
maybe it was that year.
Uh huh. Absolutely, it was.
It was that year. I remember. Remember we started that bounce, and I remember saying, "Start jumping up and down." Start jumping up and down. I said, "Start jumping up and down," because we wanted to celebrate.
Yeah, it was like a mosh pit.
It was like a mosh pit, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. The stomp or the bounce. It became to me known, and certainly in the years that followed, we didn't even know the term walk off before that, really, but. But as the years followed, everybody in baseball did that sort of thing. So that was right. Always pretty cool as a Reds fan. Nobody around the world would know that. But
so I think we could say the Reds started it.
Yes.
And to be honest, I could be totally wrong, but I think I initiated it.
Well, it's being recorded right now, so that's
the answer. I know it's being recorded, so we'll see what my teammates.
Well, if I can get anybody else.
They may have a different story, but I remember that for sure.
If I can get anybody else on here, maybe they'll confirm or deny it. I mean, I know Aaron Boone has a pretty important job right now, so I don't know if I'm going to get to talk to him.
Maybe Case Man remembers.
Maybe so. Okay. So fast forward a little bit, and I'm going to go through some of these. These are actually all in September. You had some other good games throughout the year, but September 4th, a Saturday in Philadelphia, the old vet, you beat the Phillies 22-3. And that included two by Mr. Eddie Taubensee himself. Nine home runs in the game. I mean, that's unprecedented, and you hit two of them.
I hit two. What a game. The wind, I'm telling you what, the wind was swirling that game in that bowl, that Circle Stadium, and it was blowing out. And I'm trying to remember who was pitching that for Philly. I want to say Paul Byrd started the game. But we just started crushing it. And I hit two homers that day, and everybody we put in, and we pinch hit, Mark Lewis, he hit a grand slam.
Yes.
Brian Johnson came in for me, and he hit a home run, and just all these homers. And I think it's still a National League record and tied a Major League record for nine. But the crazy thing is, people don't remember, the next day we came back and hit five more.
That's right.
And
that's right.
We hit five more and set a two-day record of 14 homers in 2 days. I hit another one the next day. We won that game 9-7. And then we went to Chicago. Then Greg Vaughn hit three homers that day, I think. And so I think we stopped hitting. He kept hitting homers. But that was a type of year. It's just kind of like special stuff like that. It just clicked. And, we weren't a big, I guess, other than Vaughn, I mean, nobody else hit over 30 homers.
Right.
And so Vaughn had like
45.
And other than that, we had lots of guys in 20s, but nobody in 30s, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either. And to your point, Paul Byrd did start that game. He was no slouch. He went 14-8 on the year. The team had three off of him. You touched Chad OJ up for three home runs as well. Ohio fans remember him with the Indians.
That's right.
So, yeah, just quite a day that the Reds had that day. And it's still immortalized. If you ever see like the programs or the media guides, the picture of you guys that you took as a group is still always in there.
I have that at home too. It's funny that the next day we had all eight of us took a picture together. I got that in my office. It's a really nice picture.
Well, speaking of pictures as well, Sean Casey's been hosting his own podcast the last couple of years, and he does it on video. And I saw it was a picture of the opening day lineup, basically
lineup, yep.
In 99, and it's from behind, so it gets Jack McKeon and all you guys with the backs of your jerseys. And I actually a little over 2 years ago I broke and dislocated my right ankle, and so I had some time on my hands, and I ended up messaging he and Danny Graves on Twitter, and they told me it was actually a trainer or somebody who took the picture. And
it sure was. I got it at home too. I have that same photo.
Okay.
It's up in the house. I tracked
him down and bought it off of him. He shipped it to me and everything. So I've got it hanging up in my Reds man cave. So that's pretty cool. When you think about those memories. Hey, to go backwards, one I didn't write down, but we talk about scoring a ton of runs. Another day, it was a little bittersweet because Denny Nagel actually got hurt that day or ended up going on the injured list after that. But a wild day in Colorado, May 19th, 1999, you win 24-12. And that's a day I remember because every Reds game was not on TV back then like it is now. And I went to a Damon's. I don't know if you remember Damon's restaurants. I went to a Damon's looking to watch the game, and even they couldn't get it on the Colorado feed. So I'm driving around Ohio State's campus trying to get it on the radio, and here you guys win 24-12. What a day. Sean Casey had six RBIs.
You know what? If you look at the box score, I haven't looked at the box score. I don't know. I bet I didn't play that game.
Yeah, you did not. No.
I think I remember that. I'm just like, man, because I caught probably the two games before. Mm-hmm. And this was a getaway day game on Wednesday.
Day game.
Yeah, I was like, I was wishing that. I was like, well, no way, everybody's getting all these runs. And, but yeah, that could happen in Colorado because the other games before that probably weren't as scoring like that. But it was a lot of scoring that game because it was a 24 to 12 games.
24 to 12. Brian Johnson, your backup, had a 3-for-6 day with 4 RBI.
There you go.
Pokey Reese hit 2 home runs in the game. And of course, Sean Casey that game had 6 RBI. So he went 4-for-4 with 4-for-4 with 3 walks and 6 RBI. What a day, huh?
I know. Well, you know what? That's a lot of scoring. You know what? That could have been 90 rubies for me, maybe instead of 87, but that's the way it goes.
Oh boy, you're standing next to Skip trying to get him to put you out there for sure.
No, I was. You know what? Guess what? To be honest, as a catcher, when you're playing every day, when you see that, I'm glad because I can relax. I know I'm not going in.
That's
the game.
True. That's
and,
true.
And so to me, I did not care. I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So we fast forward again. We talked about the Phillies game Monday, September 20th. You had a 4-for-4 night. Now, you talk about trying to stay strong as a starting catcher. These are the dog days now. You get into late September. You went 4-for-4, including your 20th home run. You were the first.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, the first catcher since Johnny Bench with 20 or more. I've heard of that guy. So you had 8 total bases that day.
I did. I remember that. I hit it. My wife hates it when I remember. So I hit a changeup out and got a couple hits. I got a bunt hit that day too.
Yes, you did. I watched the replay. You did.
Jack had me sacrifice, and I don't know why. But I sacrificed, and I got a hit, and I ended up, I think, coming out later in the game. But yeah, I remember that game as well. So that was a good game. Yeah, especially to get. I was really excited to get the 20th homer because that was something. Milestone you kind of want to reach.
Well, it was funny. You had the bunt hit, but they threw it away. They still caught it a hit, but I think you reached all the way around to third base. So McKeon probably felt like he had to get you out of there.
Yeah. So I was a little bit tired, but yeah. that was a good game. Kind of like, but really that's, I always tell these young kids, and I'm coaching the college team back then when we played, we had to do those little things.
Sure.
You know what? Could we hit home runs? Yeah, we can hit home runs and drive. But we had, when it called upon, we had to get a guy over. The game called for it. The coach wanted us to do it. We had to do it.
That's right. That's right. Now they say, you know, your 7-hole hitter in the big leagues probably batted 3rd or 4th in AAA and never was asked to. So, I get you. I get you. All right. So this is going to be a personal favorite on my end. I'm going to bring up Sunday, September 26th. You're having that battle with the Astros and even, as you mentioned, the Mets to see who's going to make the division winner in the wild card spot. You're at home on a Sunday afternoon.
I remember this game.
It was just when I first started dating my now wife. We've been together all these years. We had just started dating. We decided to come down for the game from Columbus. We bought tickets. We sit there, and there was a little old lady, and she had driven down from Columbus by herself. She told us the story of her husband had died, and they used to come down for the Sunday matinees, and she just didn't want to miss out on another one. I think that was probably the last home one of the game of the year. And we sat with her and talked to her the whole game. In the bottom of the 12th inning, you got things started with a 1-out single. Brian Johnson walked, and then Pokey Reese hits a walk-off home run.
Yeah, that was some good series with St. Louis, and because a couple things, McGuire was hitting a lot of homers that year, and St. Louis came into town, so we had a lot of fans at the game,
right?
And that was a huge game with Pokey hitting that homer, and that was super huge, and. And then also there was another game that I don't know if it was that game before or the game after is there was a we beat the Cardinals.
Yeah, the next day you went 9-7. Actually, you swept the Cardinals in 4 games that series. 5-4, 6-1. Yeah.
And what was interesting about that game that we won, I think 9-7, or I think it was that game. It was one of those games, that series, is that it was at the end of the year. Mark McGuire came into town. That game, he hit a homer upper deck left field.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he hit a home run, I think he hit like a 61st, 60th.
Yeah, that was a 61st. The day before, he hit a 60th in that Pokey Reese game. So, yeah, your memory
right.
is great.
And so this game, all right, because every game for the Reds, this is the end of the year. We're fighting for the playoffs. It was like a playoff atmosphere. And I remember it was at the bottom of the eighth, Dimitri Young was on second base. We're down a run. And I come up to the plate. And the crowd is chanting Eddie, yes. Eddie, Eddie, and I was like, oh my gosh, I was thinking to myself, okay, let me just make this simple. And I was thinking, I'll just try to get a base up the middle to get Dimitri in. And the pitcher hung a slider on like a 2-2 count. I hit an upper deck homer to right field.
Okay,
to put us ahead, and we ended up winning that game. So I don't know if that's the game I hit a home run. But it was right that same time when we were playing the Cardinals and Pokey hit a big homer and things like that. So the next day I did the same thing with McGuire, went upper deck left field and I went upper deck right field.
Well, I will tell you, I told you the story of the old lady and then my now wife. I picked my then girlfriend up and twirled her around when Pokey hit that home run. And I will say to you, Eddie Taubensee was my wife's favorite player. Her first favorite player as a kid was Paul O'Neill, and then it was you. So you've got that going for you. She loved Eddie Taubensee when we'd watch you play. So that was pretty cool. I told her this morning, I asked her if she had anything I wanted to ask you about, and she said, no, not really. But I said, I'm going to tell him he was your favorite player. So
well, that's awesome. And I appreciate that. And I did. And Pokey Reese had a great year that year.
He did. He did. As you mentioned earlier, all the younger guys, they all kind of had played up to their potential even earlier than we would have thought it for some of them. And I know Pokey even had, it was the year before that Larkin was hurt at the beginning of the year and he started at shortstop and had a tough game, four errors in the opening day game. And certainly he became.
And what about Flavitt? Then he won about four gold gloves after that.
Absolutely.
So I think he did okay.
All right.
He had a couple of two or three.
Yeah, he was something else. So we're going to move forward to something that's not as fun to reminisce about, that cold weekend in Milwaukee. I was a student radio back then at Ohio State, so we did the football games on the air. And I remember your Saturday game, I just remember trying to tune in, and I think you had rain delays. And I know Sunday you had rain delays all day, and you got stuck playing late at night. Talk about the vibe of the team that weekend, and kind of, boy, it just felt like you could just grab it, and it just wasn't meant to be.
We were so confident, Seth, going into Milwaukee, because all we had to do, we just knew going into that weekend, because we're watching Houston play, we're watching New York play. And we just had to win two out of three.
Sure.
If we win two out of three, we're in. Whether we win the division or we're a wild card, we're going to be in. And that's all we had to do. And the first game, we had a lead going into the bottom of the ninth. We ended up, we ended up losing that lead and losing in extra innings, I remember. That was tough. Because that was the game we wanted to win. Because the second game, we got beat. They beat us pretty good. And then what was horrible is we the last game there was a rain delay, so we're watching Houston play, they win. We're watching the Mets play, they won. And we're like, oh my gosh! So if they would have lost, that could have changed a lot of things. So we're stuck. We're like, we have to pitch our best pitcher. We have to pitch Harnish. Mm-hmm. We're trying to save Harnish, our workhorse, for even the maybe a play-in game, or even the first or wild card game. But it didn't work out that way. We had to pitch. We had to win. It was a must win. So we had to pitch our best. So Pete was that guy. We won. We won handily that day, and we did our job. And we were excited to come home, and I know that they said we're playing at home. It was the game was scheduled for like a 12:30 game,
right.
1 o'clock game, but we got home at 6 a.m.
Sure,
and we ended up playing a night game, and we weren't, and obviously Leiter pitched an amazing game. I got a chance to start that game, and I did fine against them. I think I walked and I hit a line drive to second. And they just couldn't score.
No.
We just couldn't score. And And Leiter did his job, and we just it was tough. I going through that September, the way we were playing, the way we were winning, I didn't care what the scenario was. I thought there's nothing going to stop us from getting into playoffs. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be super excited personally, because I was like, now I get to be that guy. I get to catch. I'm not going to be behind Benito Santiago 95. Right. You know, and things like that. I get to be the guy, because I was the guy all year, and I was excited for that opportunity. And I thought for sure there was nothing that was going to stop us.
Well, and the tragedy of it was, and you know, I guess you looking back on it, you can't say it's anybody's fault. But you had the big rain delay on Saturday night. You played deep into the day on Sunday, and then you don't get home until so early the next morning. Bud Selig had sent the Mets. They played their game, and he sent them to Cincinnati. They were already in bed before you even got on the plane to fly back to Cincinnati. And but I do remember I bought tickets at a local Ticketmaster in Columbus, and three of us came down. That stadium was electric for that game. It was such a good thing.
And you know why we were so excited about getting into the playoffs is because back then there was only one wild card team, so there's mm-hmm. there's four teams going to go. We had that year we had the Braves, obviously, the Braves, the Astros, and the D-backs, and then obviously the Mets were the wild card team, and who won those three won the divisions, and I think the Mets started out playing the D-backs.
Yes.
I want to say.
Yep.
And we were 8-1 against the D-backs.
You certainly were. Yep.
We were 8-1. And if we got past it, even if we played Houston, we were like 9-4 against them. And so we owned those two. We were excited. We owned those teams during the regular season. And those teams that, you know, Arizona won 100 games. And boy, if we didn't beat up on Houston the way we did, they would have kind of ran away with the division more and won 100 games. But obviously the Braves owned us that year. I think they beat us 8 out of 9 yeah. times. And so we knew we would have struggled with them a little bit. It'd been tough, but we knew if we got in, we were excited about our matchups going into the first round.
Yeah. It would have been something else, but it just, I guess wasn't meant to be, but
because within our own division, those two teams, Arizona, Houston, we dominated them that year.
Right. You thought you definitely had a chance. And of course, us as fans, we were still snake bitten from the Braves, because in 92, I think the Reds had 90 wins and didn't make the playoffs. And then of course, 95 being swept by the Braves. And we always, you know, with them being on TV all the time, and it always just felt like they were that whole decade, they were just kind of in control. And I remember 98, you guys were so young, and I remember watching you play the Braves and trying to – it was almost like a measuring stick. So, that was something else too. Hey, I've kept you a lot longer than I intended, but really quickly, if you're willing, I'd like to run down a few of the teammates and maybe just get a few thoughts about each of them.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Let's do it.
Hey, so I'm just looking at the Baseball Reference. We'll go through the regular lineup. You were at catcher, and then Sean Casey. Talk about him a little bit.
Oh my gosh, Sean Casey, me and him were buds. Actually, he's the godfather of my youngest son, Matthew. Wow. We call him Chewy. So yeah, he's doing awesome. And the only thing I feel bad for Case is against Al Leiter, we had a guy at third with one out, and he couldn't get him in, mm-hmm. and that would have been his 100th ribby.
That's right, because the stats counted. So yeah,
the stats counted, and Sean Casey drove in 99 twice and never driven in 100 in his career. So I was really excited for him. But no, he was a pleasure, man. He was just, you know, just the way he played hard, and you know, just with his infectious attitude, you know, just kind of, he did a lot of things. He kept us loose, but also he was a force to be reckoned with at the plate.
Certainly was. 332 that year. We spoke a little bit about Pokey Reese. I thought I'd share. I was at a game against the Cardinals, and I believe it might have been the only hit of the game given up by the Reds, but a fly ball, it goes off the heel of Mike Cameron's glove, but Pokey ran out there, picked it up off the turf, off the bounce, fired it in, and the Reds, I assume Larkin, tagged out J.D. Drew at second base. He was so good with that arm for a second baseman. We hadn't seen anything
I tell you, before him, we had Brett Boone at second base.
Yeah, the best.
And Brett Boone was awesome. He was awesome. Gold Glover too. He won Gold Gloves. And then Pokey took over and like he got the balls that Brett didn't get to.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, his arm, you know, and obviously he could play short. He's a natural shortstop. And no, just Pokey just made it look so easy. And you just took him, for granted. Him and Barry, as soon as the ball is hit, there's like the way they turn double plays and just kind of with Pokey's range going, especially going to his right at second base, really helped Barry Larkin out to where he could cheat over in the hole a little bit. It just made him a better fielder.
Yeah, and of course the Battle of Ohio back then, and me being from up in Columbus at the time, we had to worry about people talking about Vizquel and Alomar up in Cleveland, and I remember that year too. It just felt like, hey, we've got ours too. So, but Pokey hit 285. He had 38 stolen bases that year, so he pulled his weight at the plate as well, which was a big concern going in.
Well, I think about it too. If you look at live, I think him and Mike Cameron during the year were our leadoff guys.
Yep. Both of them had 38 steals. Yep.
And to be honest, if you tried to do it all over again, you probably want to put Barry more up in the leadoff one or two hole. Because think about Barry, he's our best player. You want him to get the most at bats of the year.
Sure.
But because Barry's batting fifth most of the year behind Greg. But Barry was clutch. You know, Greg, this way he gave protection to Vonnie. And, you know, and so we needed Barry there in five hole.
We'll talk a little bit more about Barry. He was, until Vaughn came along, the elder statesman on the team at that point. But he, at 35, he still had a great year that year. What did he mean to you as a player and as a teammate?
Well, yeah, that was the year he won MVP, I'm sure, if I remember
95
right.
Actually was, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. 95. Right. 95. And in fact, it was the next year or so he had a better year where he hit 30 homers.
Exactly. 30-30.
But Barry Larkin, he was, out of all the players I play with, he was the best leader I played with. The fact is this. Early on with the Reds, you know, we would take infield like every single day. And when I was with the Indians my last year, we never took infield during his regular season. We would take it all the time, the Reds. And he would show up. Mm-hmm. He'd show up every day, take infield. And when Pokey Reese first got there, he was learning to play second or playing short. He had to come out for early work. Barry would be there. You know, Barry would always show up and do the work. And you know, stuff that he expect from other players, he would do it himself first.
That's awesome.
And when he spoke, we listened. He played hurt all the time. He played pretty much every single game. If he didn't play, you knew there was something going on. And so yeah, he deserved. He is definitely Mr. Red for us, and he is the leader, and boy, and he definitely is a Hall of Famer.
Absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely. At third
well
base,
deserving.
Yeah, at third base that year, Aaron Boone, he had come up a little bit earlier than that, played with his brother some, but then he takes over at third base. Again, one of these guys that he was only 26. You had that group of guys from ages 23 to 26 that just really made impacts. What kind of teammate was Aaron?
Aaron is a very athletic. Obviously, he is by a very athletic build, athletic body, great talent, very smart. So very, very smart. So he's all about position. He knows where to position. He's always talking baseball, always talking hitting, talking things, talking during the game, and talking. And he just got better and better the more he played because he soaked up everything. So he was. He was awesome to have on the field because he's a gamer. He's a competitor.
He was
and
fiery.
He came through for us. Yeah, he was fiery too. Yeah. Brett, he's different than Brett. Brett was really, really vocal, really fiery. Aaron was that, but to a lesser extent.
Okay.
You know, yeah, he's, you know, in that way, but they're totally two different players, but man, he was, he could hit the ball all over the field. Play smart, great third base, and just make the plays that you're supposed to do and make some really good plays.
We already talked about Greg Vaughn quite a bit, but his power was definitely felt in that lineup.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, he was the only guy who drove in over 100 runs that year. And, he was definitely, he was the force. You know, he was, when he was hot, he would carry us for sure for many days and for weeks at a time. But he would, he brought the expectations. Even when he wasn't going good, he expected us to win, and he would find a way to do things. And you know what? And you know what? He did just fine in the outfield too. I mean, he caught the balls he was supposed to catch. And I loved it, man. He'd fire us up, you know, like if we're down in a game in the middle of the game, the fifth, sixth, seventh inning, he's chirping on the bench, walking up and down, and just kind of he motivated us. Okay. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mike Cameron, we spoke about him too, but I think, you know, he only played the 1 year in Cincinnati, but Reds fans certainly remember that 1 year.
Dude, you know what? Again, I think he's just total athlete. He does everything kind of very well. Obviously, his glove out in center field, unmatched in a lot of ways. I mean, he get the ball. He's a gold glove center fielder. He could play. You knew he average-wise, he wasn't going to hit for a high average, but – when he hit, he's going to hit with some power, drive in some key runs once in a while, drop, run into some balls. But you know what? He can steal bases at any time. You know, but you got to live with the strikeouts along with the walks. Mm-hmm. He'll get on base. He had a good on base percentage and good enough. But he was good. He was amazing in an outfield. And so with him in center field, really solidified. Because we would play, we had Vonnie out there, and probably, you know, we would play guys like, we had Tucker, great outfielder. We had Tucker. We had Jeffrey Hammonds, who could play some outfield, did really well. But obviously, Dimitri Young would kind of be a kind of that right fielder, a little bit of everything too.
Sure, I was going to bring that up. Tucker, Young, and Hammonds, and Dimitri played some first base, like I know even against Randy Johnson or somebody like that when McKeon would sit Casey because Dimitri was a switch hitter. But Jack McKeon found a way to play Jeffrey Hammonds, Dimitri Young, and Michael Tucker all 120-plus games that year. That's really amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And that was the catalyst for us. If you only have a guy like Greg Vaughn driving in 100 and, Case Van was at 100, and I think I was third on the team. In RBIs, and you know, I'm not playing every day. Mm-hmm. And then to have guys like Dimitri Young, Hammonds, and Tucker, the production they have with the double digit homers and all around 50 RBIs. So that is a quality player. That's a big time player. If you add up all of, you combine those numbers, that's a guy driving in probably close to 90-100 runs and you know, 25 to 30 homers right there.
Absolutely. Well, it was such a memorable season, and you and I have talked now at an hour. I did not intend for it to be this long, as I said, but I've really, really enjoyed talking with you, Eddie, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Seth, it's been a great pleasure, and you know what? Made my day. Don't get a chance to talk about it too much, but it brought up some great memories. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.